Hi, it's Wednesday night, and let's take a look at the Parsha, which is Nasa, of course, this week, and there you have all about the Sota, among other things. That's like the most dramatic part, in my opinion, the weird story of the Sota. And this is being sponsored by our very good friends, the Beers, Mr. and Mrs. Shua Beer. I do appreciate it. He offered to do it last week. I thank him. And we need sponsors for the rest of the week, actually. You know, it's already Wednesday night. For the Haftarah and for the other part. But, so again, thank you very much. The Sota, as we all know, is a strange parsha. You know, she drinks the water, but the husband, you know, accused her. You're dealing, obviously, with what we would call dysfunctional marriages. This is a Torah's approach. When I say dysfunctional marriages, let's put it this way. You can't do the Sota ritual without some kind of circumstantial evidence. I want you to understand it. It's not simply a husband accuses somebody, whatever. That's not it. And she doesn't lose any exuva or anything like that. The husband's just a maniac and is a control freak and things like that. There's got to be some kind of evidence, which they call in the Gemara, kinu yustira. That is to say, has to be established in court. Everything is, this is judicial. You got to go through the procedures over here. It's not stamazoi. There's whole sota. It's only based in, and this is a final act, and she's given all kind of chances to back out, and there has to be a certain amount of circumstantial evidence. Torah says this. And the circumstantial evidence consists of the fact that the husband, in front of witnesses, has to warn the wife against being around this guy. And then, that's not enough. Because then any husband could just, you know, get two witnesses and say, everybody in Baltimore, or everybody in whatever town you live in, I'm warning you, stay away from them. That guy would be a nut. But rather, has to be kinyan stira. That is to say, stay away from this fellow, and then they're seen together. You understand? Now, not seen doing anything, because that's already an actionable case. When you have an actionable case, that's called an adultery case, which I can't believe ever happened. Then that's a different story. That's not, there's no Sota or anything like that. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, I think many people don't know this. They get it wrong. In order to have a real case of adultery in Jewish law, that she gets convicted, you have to have Edim and Hasra. What kind of a nut would do that? Meaning, you'd have to have a guy and a girl getting themselves in this situation. They have to be witnessed by two male Shomer Shabbos adult men who then warn them. And by the way, if you get technical, they have to tell them what the punishment is and so on and so forth. Which couple, which is surreptitiously trying to do something, is going to continue to do it in front of witnesses? Anyway, that's a sick thing. But when you know that this could get you arrested and convicted, and she could get killed. And I'm not even finished, by the way. You have to have Edim. They have to ask Ra. And then they have to matar atzal mitzvah. And the woman has to say, I know you're watching me, and I know I can get this thing. And if this goes to court, I'll get killed. And alpha begin, I'm going to do it anyway. Where is there a woman in the world? Where is there a guy in the world that talks like that? The Talmudic law is a very high bar. It's being sponsored by a lawyer, Shua Beer. So you know, you see what I'm talking about. You couldn't get a conviction on this. But if that's the case, then I'm trying to explain how the Sota fits in the Jewish law. If that's the case, and it's almost impossible to get a conviction, what's to stop any married woman from running around? Just do it with a little bit of a sense. In other words, if I was a woman and I was, you know, this type of, if I had that type of personality, right? In other words, a promiscuous individual, and she doesn't care about the consequences, and so on and so forth. So, just like this. All I have to do is make sure I don't do anything in front of witnesses and all the rest of it. And even if the witnesses were there, I'm going to do like, you know, what do they say? I plead the Fifth Amendment. The Jewish law has basically the equivalent of a Fifth Amendment, which means that, in more than the Fifth Amendment, which means that all she has to do is not answer, you know, the witnesses, and she won't get convicted. So, no, she won't get chayav misa and all that sort of thing.
So knowing that, you like have a green light for fooling around. Unless you say there's like an intermediate zone, which is when the husband warns her and she's seen alone with the guy, stira, secluded in some way or another, that's enough to get his charges accepted by the court as sufficiently credible to require her to either leave the marriage on her own and lose all of her financial rights, lose the ksuba, or insist that even though she was alone with the guy, yes, they were in a hotel together, but nothing happened. In order to prove that, she'd have to go through the Sota ritual, which is very embarrassing. As part of the whole concept of the Sota is the embarrassment part. Matter of fact, you look, I think the Meshech Chochma and others, the embarrassment itself is the kapara. So what I mean by that is, let's say she's telling the truth. And even though she hung around with this fellow who wasn't her husband, and they did all kind of suspicious looking sorts of things, so it seemed like a red light or something like that. But nothing. But in point of actual fact, nothing happened. No physical zach happened. That still was not right of her to get herself in that kind of situation. And the atonement comes through the public humiliation. In other words, the husband didn't do anything wrong. If the situation is as I described it, if he says, "Altistri and Plony, don't hang around this guy," and like I said before, they go into a hotel together and spend a couple hours there, that was wrong. And even if, in point of fact, nothing happened, she gave herself the appearance of impropriety, and the husband is not, under the Torah law, the husband is not supposed to be some, you know, lemming who says, let her do whatever she wants, all the rest of it. If they get divorced, she can do whatever she wants. That's true. But if she marries, she can do whatever she wants. Just like he can do all the things he wants to do. And so for putting herself in that circumstantially suspicious situation, she undergoes the Sota ritual, which if she's innocent, you know, so in other words, it'll come out good for her. Nisa Manixa Zara. They have all kinds of things in the Gemara, you know, people who didn't have children who did it on purpose in order they should be able to get children. And so I don't know. I don't believe you can beat the system, really. You know, you can't manipulate the Torah. Everybody wants to manipulate the halacha if they're able to. That's just a natural human tendency. You know, if you can make money on something, you'll do it. But really, really, she undergoes, she has to go into Beis HaMikdash, and they have to dishevel the hair, and they have to pull hair for her clothes off. And the Kohen is doing this and that, and people are watching. I mean, it's an extremely humiliating type of situation. When Das Alein is the kapara, you understand? Notice the public humiliation is itself, if she feels bad about it, which I assume she would, that itself is the kapara. And of course, she doesn't die, and her innocence is confirmed. But people say, all right, so you didn't do anything at all, but what the heck did you check in with the guy for? And why did you spend 2 days or whatever there? You see what I'm saying? Her misconduct, not her adultery, is what gets punished and exposed. Which is just a very interesting idea. So the Torah really is kind of covering all different sides of the marriage suspicion sort of spectrum. From having done something to not having done something but acted improperly and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, if he's just a nut and he says, don't talk to this person, and she never did, or she never did anything, you know, suspicious. For example, I'm just making this up. So he said, I don't want you to ever talk to the mailman. And let's say she talked to the mailman. I mean, mailman came on the porch, and she's in the house, and they're talking. She says, hello, this, and I don't know, whatever. You know? But there was no stira, meaning there was no business with that. She and the mailman then went off somewhere. Then there's no Sota ritual. And the husband can come home and say, I heard that you talked to the mailman and this and that and the other. That's not grounds for anything. Now, that's a dysfunctional relationship. That is true. You know, there's something wrong in the situation I just described. But I want to tell you something. You cannot legislate. The Torah even cannot legislate every kind of nutty possible situation between a husband and wife. It's such a complicated relationship, the marriage relationship, and can go in 100 different directions. You can't legislate for every single possibility. If you think about what I'm saying, you'll see. You have to go for the generality of it. And we have to go for the idea that there shouldn't be misconduct. And there shouldn't be, you know, circumstantial indications that there's misconduct. But beyond that, you can't go. Now, the truth is, at least as I understand it, the truth is that this is a very complicated business for the following reason. In the biblical times and until very recently, and still in some communities, marriage is not decided between the boy and the girl, or wasn't. But rather, you know this, long, long ago, your great-great-great-grandparents' time, how old were they when they got married? Young. 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Those were the years. Back in Eastern Europe, you know, long, long ago. And certainly in the biblical times. Today, that a guy 25 should get married to a girl 24, I mean, you know, that'd be crazy. You see? And Kal vachomer older than that. So, in that world, which is most of Jewish history, the boy and the girl don't really know each other. If he's 13 and she's 12, or he's 14 and she's 13, which kind of things happen all the time. All the time. So the boy doesn't know the girl doesn't know the boy. So what's shot in marriage? His family and her family got together and arranged a marriage. And I'm sorry to say, but usually did on terms that were advantageous, not to the boy and the girl, but to the two families. It shouldn't be that way, but it is that way. The Torah sanctions that. And so what that means is that the girl's parents or family, all the rest of it, will, you know, try to get the girl to marry somebody that's most advantageous, either financially or this, that, and the other. This is how the world worked. As a matter of fact, the opposite. They would be shocked of romantic marriages. That only started 150 years ago, something like that in Jewish history, you know, beginning of modern era. We wouldn't think today. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe I don't know how the Hasidim do it exactly. I'm very serious. Because I know it's all arranged marriages, all the rest of it. But there has to be some element of the boy liking the girl, liking the boy. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, in certain societies, perhaps, I don't know, it doesn't sit well with me anyway, whichever way you go. And the reason I'm saying that is, you often had situations of mismatches. And so, maybe financially, it works that Team Yaakov, you know, negotiates and with Team, you know, Sprinzel, and they arrange a marriage between Yaakov and Sprinzel. And Yaakov is 14, Sprinzel is 13, and they expect that it'll work out. That's how they say it, and it doesn't work out because you don't know what a kid's like when he's 13 or 14, and you don't know what a girl's like. You don't know. And especially once they start having children, all the rest of it. I mean, imagine the strains of child raising, which I think anybody listening to podcasts as children knows. And imagine that when you're not ready for it and you're only 13 or 14 or 15 or 16. Now, it's true that people used to live with their parents and all that. But even so, I don't want to get too technical, but it often didn't work out. There are a lot more divorces in Jewish history than people want to talk about. I'm saying that as a historian. People who study this topic, and you have to mind in all the sources that are available, the written sources, especially the Shals and Jews, things like that, the Takanas that are in different communities and Kehillas. It was a fair amount of divorces. And so the way it used to be was you marry a kid off very young. If it doesn't work out, a couple years later, they'll make their own marriage, right? There are many Gedolim, by the way, if you study closer to biography, they were married, then it didn't work, and then they married a second time, and it worked. So arranged marriages ain't that great. Now, I know sometimes it works, but ain't that great. And the particular problem was when you had a situation where, very often they were married relatives, and very often it's a young girl with an older guy. Now, the Gemara says you're not supposed to do that. But in spite of what I just said, they did it. And And, you know, maybe the older guy had money, or maybe the old guy was an uncle or relative, or whatever. All kind of nutball situations. This is the underside of Jewish history. And the reason I'm mentioning is, that's almost like an invitation for adultery and things of that nature. Because, no, the wife is very unsatisfied, very unhappy. She was kind of forced into this by the parents when she was too young to realize what's going on or to object or have an opinion one way or the other. And it didn't work out. The guy turned out to be a jerk, or she turned out to be just a mismatch. We all know that marriage is a chemistry board, and it's never easy, and certainly not the situation I'm talking about. And therefore, you have in the Gemara a very interesting situation that the legalists are worried about, what they call Shami Echapal Basa Choso, pity on Basa Choso, which means, you have to think it through, which means a guy married his niece, Basa Choso. Happened all the time. I think we would consider it weird, but you know, I'm just speaking as a modern American, but you know, in old times, happened a belt of times. Now, I'm not even talking about the genetic problems and all that. Let's put that aside, which really can be put aside, but let's put that aside. But it happened a lot. And so the girl could be 15 or something like that, and the guy be 40-something, or maybe even older. And why am I mentioning this? It wasn't really two people of the same age group. And so it wasn't a good match. I don't want to go into details. You can figure it out yourself. It just wasn't a good idea. And therefore, don't be surprised that the girl in this situation can seek companionship and that sort of thing elsewhere. Now, it's wrong because it's illegal, but it's understandable. And then you had the funny kind of situation that the Gemara is talking about, the Rishonim are talking about, which is a clash between Parshas Noso and real life. Parshas Noso tells us that even if she was 14 and she married a guy who was 50, she's married and she can't, you know, run off with anybody. And yet the guy is 50, is over the hill for her or something like that. And she can't find any kind of emotional, whatever, satisfaction. And therefore she's like a sad individual. And she seeks a way out. And she ends up getting involved with another person. Is she evil? She's a victim of circumstances. She's a victim of circumstances. Her family basically messed her over. I can't tell you how many times this happened in Jewish history in the past. Now hold it for a second. In the Gemara's case, so she ends up getting involved with another person. She's mezana with somebody who's not her husband, which is Issacharis and all the rest of it. That is all true. But he's not going to testify against her or do kinu estir, all the rest of it, because he realizes it's his fault. So I'm really drunk for you, a movie, but it's in the Gemara, right? He understands why she did it. And therefore, because it's his niece, that is to say, he was fond of her, he kind of sees that he himself was the cause of all this. And therefore, it pains him that she should get punished. Because let's say she's mezana, and let's say she's caught, and let's say there's Adam and Hasra and this and that and the other, however likely or unlikely it is to be. And now she's going to suffer. She might even get killed. And so in order to protect her out of human compassion, which is understandable in the case I just laid out for you, he's going to try to play with the law and jiggle the law. So, for example, there's that famous case in Gittin and in the Tosfos. How's it go? that there's a certain way, bittul aget, let's put it that way. And there's a certain way that if he does this and he does this and he does that, it can be oikered the kedushas mafreya, which means there's a way not to end the marriage in divorce, but to get the marriage annulled retroactively. Annulled retroactively. There's a certain way for it to happen. And it's not the easiest, but it can happen. And Tosis famously says, with Islam, Gimel, Lama, darling, getting somewhere over there. He says, Tosis famously says, wait a minute. If it's a way to get a marriage retroactively annulled by doing some shtick, you've opened the door to adultery, because Shemi Chababasachosa, any wife who's in a situation I just described, married to an uncle, which means, it's another way of saying, a young wife and an older husband, if she ends up committing adultery, the husband, out of a feeling of guilt, will try to save the wife. So it's not the regular, it's the opposite of what I was telling you before about a normal marriage and a husband who's a control freak and all the rest of it. Here you have the opposite extreme. Isn't that interesting? But it's part of human beings. It's a human emotion. And he will do whatever he can to trigger the annulment, because that way, if the marriage is retroactively annulled, you get it? Then she didn't commit any adultery, because it turns out she wasn't married. Do you see what I'm saying? So it wasn't even like they're divorced, like Dovin and Bathsheba. It's that they never were married in the first place. And Tosa is saying like this, wow, you just opened the green light for adultery, because everybody, if she has a willing husband, can go do whatever they want. If she gets in trouble, the willing husband who has pity on her and all the rest of it will do some shtick and get the marriage retroactively annulled. And believe me, it was a big debate. Oh, it was the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rajamam, I forget exactly, you know, in the 12th century, in the Bali Tosis and other Rishonim, what to do about this, because it seems to work. On the other hand, it seems to be like something that lessens the severity of the crime of adultery. But it all reflects what I'm talking about, which is the human life. So, you see, the Torah here in the laws of Sotah are dealing with the whole spectrum of different type of marriages. The whole spectrum. And it can't be that the husband goes around, you know, suspecting the wife. That's a wholly dysfunctional situation itself. On the other hand, it can't be the husband's such a control freak that itself leads to it. On the other hand, it can't be that the husband's so easygoing that the wife, who is, you know, immoral, takes advantage of the fact her husband's a wimpy type and runs up and does all these kind of things. Everything I just mentioned is a great danger to the family unit. And the family unit is the basic unit of Judaism. Without the integrity of the family unit, the Jewish people cannot survive. Especially when we're talking about the history of the Jews in Gaulus and in you know, scattered in different places and helpless against their enemies and all of that, etc., etc. It can't be that there's any chance for the Jewish people to survive without a strong family unit. This is why the non-from denominations today, Reform or whatever, are going down the tubes because of the weakness of the family unit, and people are marrying out, and the divorce rate is sky high. And anyway, the spouse is not Jewish anymore, so knows there's no Jewish family unit if there's no, because the two partners are not Jewish. One is and one is not. And when that happens, if there's no family unit, there's no chance for survival for the Jews. And we see this in front of us ourselves. So the Sotah is not answering the problem or dealing with the problem of the intermarriage, but is dealing with the problem within the community of the fact that you can, that, how should I put it, that people are, there are too many, that's the way to say it, there are too many marriages which are not sound. A sound marriage, I would say, will never have a problem of Sotah. I don't think anybody listening to this, I hope, can look at the parsha of Sotah other than, you know, it doesn't apply to us. But out there, it does. And if the Torah didn't deal with it in this way, then what would you do? How would we deal with these issues? So the fault will always be on those who put the shidduch together. That's what I would say. And you can only do what you can do, and people are people, so you never can control the whole situation. But if you have a situation like just before, with a young wife and an old husband or something like that, or a completely inappropriate couple that was just married off by others because they thought that this was good for the shadchanis and so forth, and these things do happen, then who deals with the detritus? Who deals with the bad results that emerge from a marriage like this? All I know is, I would not want to marry into a family. I'm talking about the kids now, the kids whose mother was a sota. You see, that means the father and mother hate each other so much they put themselves through this kind of issue. I mean, what kind of a household is that? So the Torah deals here with the underside. But guess what? The underside is part of life. So sure, we'd rather talk about, the smorgasbord at a wedding and what did the bride wear and all the rest of it, because that's the upside. But there is the other side. And since the Torah is not La La Land, it's not, Alice in Wonderland, Torah deals with real life. So it's just very interesting how it struggles to figure out some way to maintain some kind of basic balance within the marriage unit. But I'll say it again, if it's structurally unsound, for example, Bas Achoso, uncle marrying a niece and so forth, and I'm presuming that there's a big age difference between the two of them, if it's structurally unsound, then I don't think the sota will even work. And these laws will not deter these negative social phenomena. Anyway, I just thought that's a very adult way of looking at a serious phenomenon. And again, I want to thank Mr. and Mrs. Shua Beer. It's not the first time that they sponsored, and I appreciate everyone. And with that, I wish you all a good week.